What should you do if you hear something inappropriate at Thanksgiving dinner this year?
Hey, you know, Uncle Joe, he always does this. What are the options? How can we approach this?
Joe Manerick from the University of Illinois' Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations helps us prepare for discussing sensitive topics that might come up at the dinner table this week. Plus, fire departments throughout the United States are usually much whiter than the communities they serve, and that's also true in Illinois, especially Peoria, which has been trying to hire more racial minorities over the past 2 years. We'll also talk about a new statewide initiative trying to help first responders better care for people with dementia. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're just 2 days away from Thanksgiving. I know everyone's probably excited about all the food, but some of you might be dreading the conversations that might be happening around your Thanksgiving table. Are we ready for all of those difficult conversations with our loved ones or family or friends or people who just end up at the table? You know, last year, our presidential election came just weeks before Thanksgiving Day, and I think it's safe to say that hashing out our disagreements have not gotten any easier since last Thanksgiving. So how do we have those conversations? Do we just suck it up and get through the meal, even if someone's being inappropriate? Or is there a productive way we can talk about things we disagree with our friends and family members, especially when it comes to issues around race and culture? We have our next guest here who helps navigate difficult conversations. He is here to help answer your questions as well. So if you want to give us a call, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions as well to 21STShow. Joe Manerick is in our Urbana studios. He's with the University of Illinois' Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations. We talked to him last year about the very popular public seminars he gives. Last year it was called Talking with Racist Uncle Joe, an interactive exercise on discussing race with family. Hey, Joe, welcome back to the 21st. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Good meeting you.
So, Joe, I would imagine that many families will decide this year it's best to not bring politics to the dinner table. Why would you suggest just not agreeing to disagree and eating some turkey and avoiding the topics altogether?
It's a good question. I get the feeling that a lot of this is context sensitive. So I think there are some families, some group gatherings where maybe it's actually an okay thing to kind of separate what people are getting together for and approaching things more strategically rather than just kind of opening the gates to whatever emerges. So being more strategic and more thoughtful and maybe even more intentional, I think is appropriate, actually.
You know, Joe, it's been a year since we talked, and I think obviously over this past year, when we think about last year, it was just a few weeks after the election. There were a lot of emotions. People had a lot of questions on how to navigate that, whether even to ask how people voted, if people didn't know. When we're thinking about this year and all of the conflicts and conversations and violence we've seen, do you think it's different compared to where we're at, where we're at as a country this year than last year?
You know, I think the public discourse and all of the events that have been occurring for the past year have really kind of upped the ante in terms of how we're going to be able or capable of maintaining some degree of civility and openness and kind of pursuing understanding with each other. So I think I get the sense that things are even more difficult in some ways because of the kinds of signals of what's more permitted, what's more acceptable. And the kind of occurrences of situations and events, et cetera, that really suggest, you know, that there's more conflict going on and we're being exposed to incidents of more conflict. So, again, I think over the past year, I think there was a lot of anxiety, anticipatory anxiety. I think some of the events that we've seen, some of the statements that have been made or not made, have also served to kind of cultivate this sense that almost anything goes. And I think for some people who are looking to promote kind of civil engagement, promoting a kind of collaborative sense making or understanding, that sort of openness to radical difference of opinion, maybe even talking past each other, makes that more difficult.
Yeah, Joe, I wonder what you hear. You work with the University of Illinois Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations. What have you heard from students this year? What are the most common, as you said, anticipatory anxiety? I wonder what you're hearing from students about how they're feeling.
I think there's a range. I think the university's made very clear statements. University leadership has made very clear what its sort of priorities are around civil discourse. I think students are coming with the same kinds of issues they've always come with to the university context. In the university, for many, represents a place of increased diversity, diversity of perspective, of experience. Navigating that kind of diversity is not necessarily easy or straightforward. Not everybody has the kind of skills or capacities to negotiate those kinds of differences of perspective, experience, et cetera, let alone do that in a sustained sort of way. So students are coming to the table, again, with those same kinds of needs and issues as they always have been. Again, I think that the larger sort of discourse at a societal level, things that are going on politically, the crises that are being sort of manifest in the news, in the media, et cetera, things that we're hearing about that have probably been going on a long time are becoming much more salient. So, again, this ups the ante even at an emotional level.
I'm speaking with Joe Manerick. He's a social work practitioner. He focuses on anti-oppression and social justice education in communities, organizations, and higher education settings. He's been talking about the University of Illinois. And Joe, I think that makes sense in a university context. Certainly when you're in a university environment, the president or the chancellor, and in the case of University of Illinois, we've seen multiple messages saying this is what are setting the tone of what our civic discourse would be on a college campus. How do you do that within a family context when you're in a short-term situation where you may be just seeing people for a meal or for a couple of days?
I think it's a great question. Because, again, I think what happens within larger systems like universities or organizations or corporations, workplaces, that can map onto what can happen in a family or social gathering as well. So, you know, what we're hearing, for example, at the university is leadership making statements about what's expected, what's acceptable. I think setting those expectations, those norms, you know, is a really critical role that leadership plays. So who are the leaders within families? Those are the folks that I would want to encourage to kind of set the tone, set the expectations, and set out, you know, what's acceptable and how things are going to unfold. So that there's no ambiguity from other people in that in the family, et cetera, including children, visitors, et cetera. You know, and there are ways of doing that, I think, that are both, you know, clear and direct, but not overbearing as well.
Yeah. And so I imagine that in this case for Thanksgiving, also the default leadership would come to whoever's the host.
Correct.
So how could you do that in a way that's not off-putting, but also because this is a difficult thing to navigate, right? You don't want to create a situation where a situation wouldn't have arisen, but then you also don't – you want to avoid situations too.
Sure. I can imagine people, even in the invitation, you know, we're getting together to celebrate X, Y, and Z or to do, you know, A, B, and C. There'll be opportunities for people to talk, et cetera, and options for discussing issues and bringing everybody up to speed. So doing that even at the invitation level to set the tone and expectations is one thing. And then what happens during the actual event and how, again, the people who are hosting or serving as the you know, the on-the-ground leaders, how they approach that as well and how they navigate even when things start to emerge that look like they might be bringing in contention, political or whatever, that's inappropriate, say, at the dinner table. There are ways, I think, that folks can step up and remind, you know, the guests, the family members, you know, why we're here, and that there will also be opportunities later on elsewhere, et cetera, to do.
Yeah, what's an example of something you could say to do that tactfully if you're probably someone who, and I feel like this often happens when people, you know, they kind of, no one wants to start a confrontation. And when a confrontation happens, sometimes there's just a lot of innocent bystanders who are kind of just sitting there while maybe two people are yelling at each other. So how do you navigate that?
I think there's a matter of style, but I have, you know, some people can be very clear and very direct, you know, be cool, save that for later. We're here to enjoy a meal. We're here to enjoy each other. There'll be opportunities to talk later about those sorts of things, whatever those sorts of things might be. And even nonverbal sort of things, you know, again, if you've set the expectation and somebody is sort of pushing on the boundaries of that expectation, then, you know, I can imagine people giving some nonverbal cues to say, chill out or later or, you know, not cool. So I think there's a variety of different things. And I know some folks last year were kind of calling in and saying, you know, even in the front end, you can create ground rules of how we're going to be together. No talking politics, no talking religion, no talking, you know, whatever the contentious issues might be for the time being, or however long, because, again, the host is in charge.
And what do you do if you're not the host? And I wonder also sometimes if these are generational issues, if you're a younger person, a college student who's maybe home and upset at something an older relative has said, especially if they think it's something where they say something and they think maybe this is racist. How would you suggest someone who's not the host handle it?
No, it's a great question. And this is one of the, I think, the complexities of what we're talking about. So even culturally, you know, there are different norms associated with how younger folks in younger generations are supposed to treat people who are elders, whether it's family members or otherwise. So a couple of things come to mind. Again, the nonverbal sort of mindful, respectful sort of things can be very appropriate. I would also, you know, so one of the questions in the scenario is, you know, somebody's here to, you know, that they're going to be making a racist joke. It's Uncle Joe. He does this every year. What are the options? And one of the options is to not laugh and to make it clear that you're not laughing. The other thing to think about is, you know, if there are people that you suspect or have seen historically who are kind of coming to the table and, you know, they have various different kinds of motivations. In the exercise that I do, the scenario really is, you know, Uncle Joe comes every year with his latest racist joke. So there's no guesswork as to, you know, if he comes this year, this is probably what he's going to do. What's really interesting is that a lot of students, a lot of participants in these kind of workshops, you know, think in terms of that moment at the dinner table. You know, the comment is made, now what do I do? And again, the way that I've even set up the exercise, it's to recognize that we're not completely ignorant of where people are coming from and who's going to be at the table and the probabilities or possibilities of what people are going to be saying. It's interesting to me that it's relatively seldom that somebody says, well, let's do something proactively. If we know this is going to be happening, and, you know, it's Uncle Joe who's going to be probably saying something weird or goofy or, you know, unacceptable, what about kind of talking to him a month before or a day before or, you know, giving him a heads up or something like that? Just to kind of share what your thoughts are and feelings are about those things in the past and how that would make you feel or think if it happened again. So again, it's creating a kind of transparency. It's a kind of a strategy of using information and communications to maintain the sort of relationship, maybe even enhance it. I mean, if this is new information for your relative, that actually might be helpful. So when I did this exercise actually last week with a group of students in a class we're teaching on marginalization, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that if we don't say something to a person, you know, who holds, say, a position of respect, again, this could be in the family, it could be workplace, it could be in a committee that you're working on. The likelihood of them changing their behavior is relatively little, right?
Right. And you have an interesting thing also, a question you ask where you say to people, it's a good, great response. If you haven't planned anything, you just say, what do you mean by that?
Exactly.
I mean, and that's probably an example of a way to interject and maybe make someone realize, I don't really get what you're saying or why you're saying that. And that's probably a respectful way to do it as well.
Yeah. And again, there are ways of using humor. What do you mean by that? Kind of unpacking. I mean, so there are a number of options, or you can even, I mean, some people have suggested giving contrary information. Well, that's not my experience. You know, this is what I've seen. These are the kinds of statistics that I've read. I'm not really sure. And so helping somebody else unpack that. But again, there's an assumption that they're not necessarily knowingly sharing information that's either promoting stereotypes or overgeneralization or other kinds of misinformation. If somebody's intent is to simply use stereotypes to promote humor at the, you know, in a group gathering, then again, your strategy or your approach might need to be different as well.
So think about people's intent as well. It's a good way to also think about approaching the Thanksgiving table and thinking that everyone has the best intentions, and hopefully that will help make conversations a little easier and more fun. Joe Manerick is a social work practitioner. He's also with the University of Illinois' Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations. Joe, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Happy Thanksgiving. For tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're going to spend the rest of today's show talking about first responders, and we're going to start with firefighters. Like many communities across Illinois, the city of Peoria is lagging behind when it comes to minority hires in both its fire department and police force. Peoria set ambitious goals to try to change that, but a new report unveiled last week during a city council meeting cast doubt on those efforts and shows just how hard it is to get first responders who look like the communities they serve. Consider this. Racial minority groups make up about 40% of Peoria's population, according to the most recent census data. But among the city's first responders, though, they're just 19% of the police department and 14% of the fire department. As I said, today we're going to be focusing on firefighters. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Peoria's fire department chief, Charles Loss, and Captain James McCoy about their efforts. We're also later going to be talking with Jim Wimbush. He's a retired Chicago firefighter, and he's founder of the African-American Firefighters and Paramedics League. But first, we're joined by Peoria Journal-Star's political reporter Chris Kergard to tell us about that report that came out from City Hall last week. Hey, Chris, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla. It's good to be back.
So, Chris, the new report out by City Hall shows that Peoria is falling short of goals that were set back in 2015. Can you remind us of what these original goals were and how ambitious they were?
They were quite ambitious over a 10-year time period. As you noted, the percentage of minorities in the city is roughly just shy of 40%. And at the time back in 2015, the minority percentages were half that or even less, 18% for the police department and 14% for the fire department in 2015. And they set themselves what amounted to a 10-year set of goals with annual increases in those numbers over that time to try to reach closer to hitting that 40% number by 2025, launching a series of other programs and initiatives to help home grow local talent out of the community that is more likely to reflect the community if you're getting members from within it, as well as making tweaks and changes to some other efforts, the way they test, the way they hire those officers and firefighters. And while they are falling short 2 years in on their goals, in theory, the police department should have gone to nearly 22% by now, fire department to just over 17%. They're actually both a little shy of that, at about 19.5% and 16%. So below the numbers they had hoped for, although within striking distance of reaching those numbers if they are able to step up the effort, and equally importantly, if they're able to continue to hire employees, given some of the budget concerns that are out there.
Right. So, Chris, can you tell me a little bit more about what Peoria has done along the lines of, as you mentioned, recruiting and similar initiatives to have people from within the community? Is that recruiting even at the high school level?
It is, yes. What the department has done, both police department and fire department, have started either explorer or cadet programs that aim to bring in students and provide them some of the early training with an eye toward getting them in the pipeline to be hired. In addition to that, there are also programs that are offered through one of the local high school career centers for fire training there that then can continue and offer them collegiate level credit and a transition into collegiate programs at the local community college that leaves students coming out of Peoria Public Schools, the largest school district in the area and the highest minority concentration in the area, that leave them in a position where they are prepared to be hired at the end of either that training process or the police explorer or fire cadet program. They've learned the ropes. They've been with local officers and firefighters. They've had some experience commensurate with their skill level as what amounts to a trainee, and they have a relationship that's established with the department, so that provided their testing on the police or firefighter exams bears out, they're then eligible as a potential employee for the department.
Chris, what was the idea behind the original implementation of this program in 2015? Was there, can you give us a little of the history there? What was sort of the idea behind trying to make this a goal?
Well, the local NAACP had conducted research and gathered information on what the numbers were for minority employees, and they came up with some fairly staggering concerns about it, including the number of minorities who had been hired into the departments since within the past decade, and that number over the past decade was scant to non-existent depending on the department. And by presenting those numbers, it was really kind of an eye-opener for the Peoria City Council at that point as to what the department actually looked like compared to the percentages of the population. Now, certainly, there's never going to be an exact 100% statistical match, but the deep concern was you have an increasingly changing population in the city of Peoria, a growing minority population, and a sense, a feeling of disparity between the minority community and others in the Caucasian community. And the city council really made a commitment, as did the leaders in both departments, that they felt it was important that their departments reflected the community that they were serving in. They stepped forward with a series of other recommendations, continuing to work with the NAACP, including changes to the frequency for police and fire recruitment, publicity efforts on reaching out to the community. They've had billboards and other outreach on the benefits of people trying to join either of the public safety departments. There's been a substantial push out there reminding people that these are good middle class head of household jobs, which is particularly important in a minority community where household income drastically lags Caucasians in the Peoria area. And they've also, again, committed to the creation of some of those programs, like the Cadet or Explorer programs.
That's Peoria Journal Star reporter Chris Kjærgaard, who was reporting last week on this issue for us. Hey, Chris, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Peoria's Fire Chief Charles Loss is with us, as well as Captain James McCoy, both of them on the line from Peoria. Chief, Captain, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nyla. It's good to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Chief, let's start with you. As you were just listening to Chris talk about the fact that this goal was set in 2015 to have particularly your department, firefighters, be more reflective of the community of Peoria, this is something that was a goal that was passed to tasked on to you by City Hall. How important is this for the fire department to your mind? How important is it to have firefighters look like the communities that they're serving?
That's extremely important. You know, we have taken that task on willingly. I mean, that is something that we actually look forward to. You know, we have, and I think like Chris mentioned earlier, we have worked on a strategy where we are getting into grade schools, middle schools, into the high school with the dual credit program, which, you know, really does get us into the grassroots. You know, we're able to show some of these kids the light at the end of the tunnel here. It's a pathway to success for them. They come out of that dual credit program with not only high school credits, but by the end of this program, I believe it's like 15 credits that they will get through the community college, Illinois Central College, at no cost to them. They also end the course, if they take it through the entire course, they end up with an EMT basic license. If they pass everything, they pass the course, they pass the state exam, they pass all the practicals. So they have an opportunity exiting high school with a pathway to be able to find a career. And after high school, we have the cadet program. You know, our cadet program, currently, what we have is really showing these kids what the fire service is all about. Prior to that, there's the Explorer program. And again, they get a good taste of what the fire service is all about. So being able to put these all together, to offer to our Peoria kids, and to get a department that looks like our community is extremely important to all of us.
Right. Captain McCoy, you've been a firefighter for 20 years. I wonder when you first started, how many of your colleagues were also Black?
I'm going closer on to 27.
27, and, wow, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. When we came on, the numbers were not as high, but we were in an area where we were looking to grow. I also heard you mention Mr. Winbush. I'm actually the president of the Afro Firefighter chapter here in Peoria as well. So I'm familiar with Mr. Winbush because of the guy who was my mentor, Chief Parker, and those guys got together who started the association a long time ago. But the numbers were lower back then, and we took a little spike back 20 years ago, but then after that spike, we froze for a long period of time until the recent regime under Chief Loss, who implemented some things that started us in the right direction. And even though we did fall a little short of this year, but we were able to have a consensus that we're going the right direction as long as we can keep implementing these things that we got in place or that we put in motion.
Yeah, well, I wonder if I can ask you, and Captain, let's start with you, and Chief, if you could follow up. What challenges do you think you all have faced while trying to recruit more firefighters of color, whether they're African-American or Latino or Asian-American? Captain, what do you think the biggest challenges are?
You know, that varies. It really depends on where we're recruiting at. When we go to the junior colleges, a lot of the kids are unaware of the career opportunity. When we go to the four-year colleges, you know, a lot of people have never been presented firefighting as a career. They don't really understand the business of being a professional firefighter. So we struggle with the level of introduction. We're making an introduction to this career to a lot of them. That's how the grassroots program really got through to the forefront, about us getting at these kids earlier to teach them about this career that a lot of them were unaware of. And then when you go farther back, some people were aware of it then, but the opportunity wasn't there for them. So, but this day and age, is a lot of the kids aren't aware of the type of career that this offers and provides to put you in a position to take care of your family.
Chief, do you think it is a question of awareness, particularly among communities who haven't, as you know, it strikes to mind what Captain McCoy was saying about having a mentor or seeing people who, you know, maybe having a dad or a brother or an uncle who's a firefighter. Is that part of the issue, too, that a lot of times firefighters end up in that profession because of other family members?
You know, I do think that awareness has a lot to do with it. And that's one of the things that we have started working on, is getting into seeing these kids early. You know, giving them the opportunity to see that yeah, we fight fires, but there's a lot of other things that we do beyond that. And some of these kids see that now as, you know, more opportunities. I think it's also what this recruitment committee has done, which Captain McCoy is a very active part of, is gotten out to the community colleges, to the universities, but also to community events. You know, one of the things that we're really trying to do is to get our department that has a similar look to our community. But the other part of that is, I mean, it's multifaceted, because the other dimension to that is that we're trying to get more Peoria kids and give these Peoria kids the opportunity at the same time. And that's what this recruitment committee has worked very, very hard in community events, local schools, not only going out and about, but, you know, that awareness locally. Our current list, I think, is the top 16 in our current list. I believe there are 12 of them that are Peoria kids.
Yeah, Chief, how many numbers, I mean, when we're talking about, we've been talking about percentages, how many folks are you actually looking to hire or recruit?
We're going to be allowed to, I believe it's 12 is what we're going to be hiring off of this list on this first round. So we're putting the first 16 through the process, which starts with background and polygraph. So that first 16 has started through the process right now. And of that first 16, we have 7 that are minorities.
Okay. And as you think about that, Chief, we've just got a little bit of time here before the break. For you, I mean, what's your priority with this going forward? It sounds like, do you feel like you're on track to meet the goals that the city has set for the next 10 years?
No, I think we have a lot of work to do. You know, the ship is turning, but we still have a lot of work to do. You know, with the efforts that we've made with recruitment efforts, that committee has worked very, very hard in getting the word out. But it's a start. You know, we've got a lot of work ahead of us. It's enjoyable work. We do enjoy it, because we're starting to bring these kids in. We're starting to see a little bit of result from that.
Yeah, and you're getting out into the community as well. We've got to take a break, but I want to thank Peoria's Fire Chief Charles Loss for joining us. Captain, if you can stick around, I'm actually going to reunite you with Mr. Winbush on the air after the break as he joins us. But Chief, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about firefighters. The vast majority of them across the country are white. We've been talking about how that's not reflective of the general population and specifically about how Peoria's fire department has been working to make their department more representative of their community and their efforts specifically to hire more Black, Latino, and Asian American firefighters. We've been speaking with Captain James McCoy from Peoria's Fire Department, a 27-year veteran of the fire department. I want to welcome one other gentleman to the conversation, retired Chicago firefighter Jim Wimbush. He retired in 1997 as a captain after a career spanning parts of four decades. He's the founder of the African American Firefighters and Paramedics League of Chicago. Jim, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me as well.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
As we're talking about this, as you're listening to, I wonder, Captain McCoy, if I could just follow up with what the chief said. You know, he said there was lots of work to be done, and he talked about the work you're doing on your recruiting committee. To your mind, what are the most important priorities and things you all can be doing going forward to address this problem to create a more diverse firefighting force within Peoria?
Like you said, there's so many different parts to that. It started, we addressed the awareness, and then after we covered the awareness, then it started from, you know, the application process, and then the qualifications, and all those different things that a lot of people sometimes didn't understand what it took, to, if they were qualified or not qualified, and then It even tied to the testing process and how the testing process played out, the physical agility, the interviewing process. I mean, we had to make tweaks on every single aspect of that process. It wasn't just one part. We made adjustments on every aspect of the whole hiring process. And that's what you have to do if you even want, like the chief said, we're starting to do a turnaround. Yes, we definitely got plenty of work to do. But we had to investigate that all the way through. I had to meet with people and go through previous testing process and see where people were falling out at, seeing how many people we were losing in the application stage, see how many people we were losing in the interviewing stage, see how many people we were losing in the testing process stage. And after all that research, then we were able to put together a formula or a plan that we tried to implement to try to address it. So it has multifacets of routes that you got to pursue.
Jim, as you're hearing, both of you are captains. I'm going to go with Jim versus Captain James here. As you are hearing Captain McCoy speak, I wonder, as he's talking about testing and other processes, how you think those that whole process of just even bringing people into firefighting needs, if you think there needs to be changes made to be more inclusive, but certainly I imagine everybody also wants to maintain standards of having great firefighters out there.
Well, first of all, let me congratulate the captain on the phone. Do you hear how intelligent he is, how intellectual he is, how he has a grasp of just the overall circumstance and situation, and how he's making all kinds of applications to overcome, identify and overcome this problem. I mean, he is extremely articulate. He is a fine example of what Peoria firefighters are. And I just wanted to congratulate him on that part. But the overall situation is that we've been in Chicago with Black firefighters for 144 years, and we still haven't solved the problem, okay? My first Blacks came on 1873 after the second Chicago fire. There was only 50 Blacks on the department. from that time until 1943, when my father and a group of black firefighters challenged Mayor Kelly and threatened politically repercussions, and he then hired 50 black firefighters. So from 1943 until I came on in 1965, they had only hired an additional 50 black firefighters. I was the last firefighter hired under segregation. And in 1965, July the 16th, 1965, a little bit over 50, 60 years ago, whatever that was. And the thing is that it's always been a resistance. It's always been some question about, oh, did black folk want a job? Of course they do. Of course they did. You notice that you have a large number of whites, but there's no white recruitment program. But all of a sudden, when you get to minorities, especially black men, now you have to have a specialized program. You've got a very intellectual brother expressing everything that needs to happen. No, the fact of the matter simply is this. It is racism, period, point blank. The solution, get a U.S. attorney. These are federal dollars. This is money stolen from the citizens of Chicago, Peoria, and everywhere else. When somebody loses their job and somebody goes to jail, this will change, okay?
So to your point, Jim, I mean, I guess Captain McCoy, as you're in the police force, and obviously racism is something, as we know, that's just a systemic problem in this country. Fire department. For your department, Captain McCoy, I wonder if that's also something that you see maybe younger black men or other young men of color might be worried about becoming a firefighter because they're worried about having colleagues that are racist or those other things. How do you handle that, Captain McCoy?
The things that Mr. Wimbush are talking about are accurate and have been accurate from a long time ago and goes all the way back from Chief Parker, who, when he taught me and told me everything, when he brought me into the job and explained things to me, there has always been a level of racism that's set in certain areas. Today's age, racism doesn't show its face the same way, so sometimes it's harder to be able to recognize. When we went a long period where we didn't hire any minorities, and I'm talking, this is in my recent time,
this was actually over the past decade, right? Because that was...
Correct. We hired like 80-something firefighters, and there were two minorities or three, something, some real low number like that. And then that's what created, because you can't just say racism unless you can prove it. And so that's when we got together with this recruitment committee. And like I said, before we could start that, I had to get with other people, and they assisted me, and we had to look into everything to figure out where are all these problems happening. And like I said, there was issues in the application process and how they were eliminating people. There was issues in the interviewing stage, how they were eliminating people. And once we dug deep into there, a lot of the reasons the numbers are what they are, because there were always some people who weren't motivated to see those numbers change. And we'll go one step farther. Some of them actually put some safeguards in to make sure those numbers would never slant too far the other way. Now, I have to give my chief that we have now a lot of credit, because these were things I brought to him. I brung to everybody, and I said, hey, look, either we address this or legal actions were going to have to be taken. And they actually made some changes, and I was able to see positive direction switch, because from the previous regime, there were some things in place that I don't believe were mistakes.
So let me ask both of you this last question just to wrap this up. Do you feel optimistic about the future? Let's start with you, Jim.
Oh, yeah. The only way we made progress, I came on as 150 blacks on the job. After I filed a series of lawsuits, mostly of which was 73C661, after I went to the federal government, went to the Justice Department, even in the Nixon administration, we went from 150 blacks on the fire department to 1,000 blacks on the Chicago Fire Department out of 5,000 employees. That all came from either legal going to court, suing the city of Chicago, successfully any number of times. I will do that on the drop of a hat. Or now we are using a lot of political strain. We have had a series of racist mayors, and with exception to Harold Washington, who died 30 years ago. But every one of them, including Rahm Emanuel, are the most racist people that you can possibly find. And that trickles down into the Chicago Fire Department, as it does in every other city department. And unless you really fight these people, you will not progress against these people. It's simple as that.
That's Jim Wimbush. He's the founder of the African American Firefighters and Paramedics League of Chicago. His opinions on the fire departments, as he's been talking about with Chicago. I want to thank Jim, and I also want to thank Captain James McCoy for giving us the situation in Peoria and helping us understand a little bit more about how one Central Illinois Fire Department is trying to change this. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
While we're on the topic of emergency responders, a new state of Illinois initiative is trying to help police and paramedics provide better care for individuals with dementia. It's called the Silver Search Awareness Campaign Program, and it's the result of a bill sponsored by Democratic Senator and gubernatorial candidate Daniel Biss of Evanston, as well as Democratic Representative Natalie Manley of Joliet. Joining me now to tell us a little bit more about this program is Erna Colburn, Region 9 leader and chapter executive for the Illinois Alzheimer's Association. Erna, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So what's the plan with this initiative? How will it help police officers or paramedics respond to people who possibly have Alzheimer's or a different types of dementia?
Well, we know that 60% of those with Alzheimer's are going to wander at some point during the course of their disease. And they can often get very far from home utilizing cars and other forms of transportation. And this bill is going to allow families, the minute they know that they have someone missing, to alert the police. The state police will become involved. And there'll be alerts that are put out for people to be able to find the individual quickly. There are sort of three main areas that this bill is focusing on. One is training. The very first thing we're going to do is create a toolkit for law enforcement. This is going to include visor cards for patrol cars so that if they encounter someone who appears to have Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, they'll have a list of protocols to follow. This will include the law enforcement, first responders, telecommunicators, and we'll provide, you know, awareness of the proper techniques that they should deal with. Over the next 2 years, we're going to train more than 2,500 police officers and dispatchers, and a new curriculum is being part of the Law Enforcement Academy training for new officers.
Yeah, Erna, we just have a minute or two left here, but I just wanted to ask you what's missing, you think, in the way first responders right now are responding to people with dementia or Alzheimer's?
Well, I think they're encountering more and more occasions when they encounter someone who has dementia. It's not that there's something lacking at this point. I think it's just becoming more and more of a reality in their day-to-day work. And so we want to make sure that they are equipped. The Illinois State Police are a terrific partner with us. And we just want to make sure that law enforcement have the tools they need to know how to respond properly as this condition grows in our population.
Right. And as we think about that, can I just ask you quickly what you think, in addition to providing training for first responders, this training program is also to help promote general public awareness. So I wonder in just our last minute here, if you can just give us a quick sense of what you think warning signs are to speak of maybe somebody with dementia.
Well, obviously the first one is memory issues, people who forget recent events, perhaps what they had for lunch, aren't able to articulate that, confusion over doing tasks that they have done all their life, you know, an accountant who can no longer do math, for instance, is a warning sign. There are many, and if you go to the www.alz.org website, you'll be able to find the list of 10 warning signs. That can help educate. Also, calling our 800 number is a good way to get information.
Thank you for that, Erna, for a quick update on not just what our our police department, our other first responders are learning about people with dementia, but also just a quick sense for folks. That website, Illinois Alzheimer's, Erna's with the Illinois Alzheimer's Association. We will have links to everything she talked about at our website at 21stshow.org. Erna, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
As I said, you can head to 21stshow.org for that information. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Our handle is 21stshow. That does it for us today. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, and Bob Hawley. Libby Foster and Grace Stetson are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.